The Rutgers University School of Business at Camden presents the second quarter quarterly business outlook. This program was recorded April 25th, 2012, at the Rutgers University Student Center in Camden, New Jersey. I'm your podcast host, Steve Lubetkin. Welcome to the Rutgers University School of Business Quarterly Business Outlook for the second quarter of 2012. We're here once again at the Student Center on the campus of Rutgers University in Camden for this program in the series. On the panel today are the following experts. Speaking about the general economy is Dr. Joel Naroff, the president and founder of Naroff Economic Advisors, a strategic economic consulting firm. Joel Naroff's a nationally recognized economic forecasting expert who's received numerous honors. In 2011, he received the National Association for Business Economics Outlook Award as the top economic forecaster. In 2008, he was awarded the Lawrence Klein Award for Blue Chip Forecasting Excellence. Joel was the Bloomberg Business News top economic forecaster in 2008, and in 2006, he received that honor from MSNBC. Joel has bachelor's degrees in economics and chemistry from the Stony Brook University and a PhD in economics from Brown University. He's a frequent contributor to 3-2-1. He's a member of the board of directors of the Economy League of Greater Philadelphia, teaches at the Central Atlantic Advanced School of Banking, is a past chair of the American Bankers Association's Economic Advisory Committee, and a past president of the Philadelphia Council of Business Economists. Our second speaker on the panel is Bruce Paparone, president of Bruce Paparone Incorporated, a company that builds primarily single-family, move-up luxury homes and communities in the southern New Jersey region. He's also a partner in the Oak Mortgage Company and owner of S.J. Paparone Insurance Agency. Bruce is a past president and member of the board of directors of the Builders League of South Jersey and also sits on a variety of boards, including Kennedy Hospital and Cornerstone Bank. In 1994 and 2010, he was awarded Home Builder of the Year, and in 1997, 2001, 2007, 2008, and 2009 was presented the Commitment to Excellence Award from the Builders League of South Jersey. He holds a bachelor's degree in management from Fairleigh Dickinson University. And the last speaker on our panel is David Hanrahan, the founding president and CEO of Capital Bank of New Jersey, a commercial bank headquartered in Vineland, New Jersey. Hanrahan also serves on the bank's board of directors. David holds a Bachelor of Science degree in accounting from Rutgers School of Business in Camden. He's also a graduate of the Stonier Graduate School of Banking from the American Bankers Association, University of Delaware. Hanrahan serves on the board and as secretary of the Cumberland County Habitat for Humanity, and he's on the investment committee of the Southern New Jersey Council of the Boy Scouts of America. He's a member of the American Bankers Association Community and Economic Development Committee and the Vineland Rotary Club. He's a past board member of the Gloucester County Chamber of Commerce and a past treasurer of Fellowship Bible Church in Mullica Hill, New Jersey. And he's also a guest professor for the annual Rutgers University Guest Professor Program. And once again, moderating the panel for this program is Dr. Jaishankar Ganesh, Dean of the Rutgers School of Business at Camden. At the lectern to introduce today's program is Frank Wisniewski, chairman of the real estate practice at the Cherry Hill Law Firm of Flaster Greenberg, the program's presenting sponsor.
Good morning. I'm Frank Wisniewski, chairman of Flaster Greenberg's real estate group. And on behalf of Flaster Greenberg, I am pleased to welcome you to the 73rd Rutgers Quarterly Business Outlook. Rutgers started the Business Outlook in January of 1994. In 1999, the Chamber of Commerce of Southern New Jersey and Flaster Greenberg became co-sponsors of the Outlook with Rutgers, and that relationship has continued for the last 52 programs. As a former adjunct professor at the Rutgers School of Law, I'm pleased to be back on campus. It's really nice, and it's nice that Rutgers has started recently to host the Outlook here. Being a full-service commercial law firm serving businesses and individuals throughout the Delaware Valley, Flaster Greenberg values our strong partnership with Rutgers University Camden, School of Business, and the Chamber of Commerce of Southern New Jersey. These two institutions represent some of the very best resources for growth and business development in our region. We believe you will find today's program interesting, valuable, and rewarding. It is my privilege to introduce Kathleen Davis, Executive Vice President and Chief Operating Officer of the Camden Chamber of Commerce of Southern New Jersey. Kathy?
Thanks, Frank, and good morning, everyone. We're so pleased to be here and to partner with our good friends at Flaster and, of course, Rutgers Camden, and to be featuring such a distinguished panel today. I know you're really going to enjoy it. In this economic climate, as you all know, and you're going to hear a lot about it today, maintaining your membership in our chamber is more important than ever, because there's really no other business organization in our region that offers the quality and quantity of events that we do, and they're really networking opportunities to help you grow your business and give you the advantage over your competitors. So, and if you're not a member, you might be asking yourself, what's the right business organization to join? And we believe it's the Chamber of Commerce, Southern New Jersey. It's the right people, the right companies, and the right events, all of which are there to help you to grow your business. So if you're interested in membership, I know that our membership folks are here today, Diana Meyer-Kennard and Michelle Johnston, who I know would love to speak with you. With that, I want to close by thanking our partners once again, Rutgers Camden, Flaster Greenberg, for all of their support over many, many years. And I'm pleased to turn the program over to Dr. Jai Ganesh, Dean of the Rutgers School of Business, Camden. Dr. Ganesh?
Thank you very much, Kathy. Good morning, everybody. You know, I just learned that the 73rd installment, I had it as the April issue of the Quarterly Business Outlook. So it's good to know that. Welcome to the 73rd installment of the Quarterly Business Outlook, you know, offered by Rutgers along with our partners. I'd like to thank our partners because, you know, their sponsorship makes this event happen every single quarter. I'd like to thank Flaster Greenberg and the Chamber of Commerce of Jersey, Southern New Jersey, for their ongoing support for this program and for their support to Rutgers Camden. I also want to thank our production crew, Choose Crews, who are filming this event for broadcast and on Comcast, and Steve, our podcaster. Thank you so much for this. Today's event actually starts at a very interesting moment. You know, as I was driving in this morning, on NPR, you listen to the usual, you know, what's going on in the world. And they were talking about the British economy maybe slipping back into recession. You know, when we look at where we are today, are we recovering? There are signs that say we are recovering. Are we recovering fast enough? I don't think so, or at least we don't see it. It looks like a recovery in slow motion. The slow-mo recovery. We seem to be running a lot to stay in place. That's what it seems to be happening, because the numbers say that January and February, our growth, job growth was about 240,000. Then in March, it was half. Consumer spending, while it is increasing, which is good, but it is not good enough as in the previous recovery times. We are running about 2.1% in consumer spending growth. Inflation is the one indicator that seems to be in control. Housing seems to have hit the rock bottom price-wise, so that's good news, which means the starts can go up. Banking, we look like more loans are being offered. Now, I have hit all these topics. I have raised more questions than answers. The reason is we have a panel of three very distinguished experts who are going to address all of this and answer all our questions. So the rules today are each of our experts are going to take about 10 to 12 minutes and present their perspective on the various segments, on their areas of expertise. And then I want to throw it open to the audience for enough time for Q&A, because at this juncture, if you are like me, you have more questions than answers, and here is a great opportunity to get those questions answered. So I'm going to start with the introduction of our very familiar face, Mr. Naroff. Dr. Naroff. Joel Naroff is the president and founder of Naroff Economic Advisors, a strategic economic consulting firm. He is a nationally recognized economic forecasting expert. He has got multiple honors. I'm not going to read the entire list. All I can say is he is such a great expert and does a great job. We like him to come back every single quarter if he's available. With that, I'm going to pass it on to Joel.
Thanks, Dean Ganesh. I appreciate the introduction and your comments about the economy. And since I agree, I'd like to say that's my talk for today. I'm supposed to fill in the blanks. I apologize. It's been a little while since I've been here, and part of that was for so long I've been coming here, and my talk has essentially consisted of saying the economy's bad, any questions. This is a different one, and unlike others, I really feel that conditions are changing, and changing for the better, and that we've already established a foundation for decent growth going forward. Indeed, the head of the Blue Chip Forecasting Panel, which I'm a part of, called me up and said, and this started, is almost every month now since October, he keeps saying to me, Joel, you're the most optimistic person on the panel. Now, that may be good, that may be bad, but that's where I stand. But I think the important thing in looking at the growth that we have, and it's the problem that Dean Ganesh alluded to, is that this recovery is just not a strong recovery. So the first thing I want to do is provide a little bit of perspective on why I've said, and I've said this for a long time, that this is the recovery we were always going to get. We were never going to get a strong recovery. And the answer to the reason is very, very simple. If you think about how we got into the recession to begin with, the housing bubble eventually burst. And with that, the financial sector neared worldwide meltdown conditions. That's what got us into the recession. That's what 2008 and 2009 was all about. Well, when you take a look at recoveries, when you think of a recovery as a rocket ship, what's the first stage that typically ignites to get the recovery going? It's housing. People usually have their equity left in their homes. Prices might have gone down, but they usually go down very, very little. And after not being able to move for 12, 18 months, they start looking around and say, hey, it's time to get back into the market, do the things I want to do. And housing, usually the first quarter after the end of a recession, housing starts growing and starts growing rapidly. Now, this is important because if you think about it, each housing start generates about 2.5 jobs. And we're down somewhere in the range of at least 300,000 to 400,000 housing starts, even now, compared to what a normal, I don't mean a strong period of time, a normal period would be. So we're looking at something in the range of 750,000, a million jobs, just because of that sector. And that sector was never going to ignite because between 2004 and 2008, we probably built 50 to 75% too many homes. And those homes are overhanging the market. We have a large number of distressed homes, millions of distressed homes, which makes it extraordinarily difficult for builders to compete. So the first stage in a normal recovery, which is the housing market taking off, generating lots of jobs, generating lots of income, and starting the process, was never going to happen. When you take a look then, as the normal recovery goes on, what's the second stage? Well, it tends to be the financial sector. It takes a while for chief credit officers to figure out that the recession is over. But after a year, 18 months, and they see the financials getting better on the businesses, they start providing credit at a much more reasonable pace. And the easing of credit goes along at a fairly rapid rate. And that makes more money available. Lending picks up. Spending picks up. And we have stage two of the recovery rocket. Well, in this recovery, where we had so many large financial institutions, essentially be brought to their knees, where the financial sector is in difficult shape, is trying to rebuild their capital base. While credit is being made more available, it's not being made as available as it would have been in a normal recovery. So stage two was never going to ignite or never provide the kind of power that we would have seen in a normal recovery. So when you look at this, we have a recovery, but it was never going to be a strong recovery. You know, we're 3 years into the recovery. I know most people can't believe that, and when I tell people, you know, that the recession ended in June of 2009, they all look at me and they turn me off, because nobody can be part of this country or the business community if you really think the recession ended in June of 2009, but it did, okay? The reality is we've only seen a slow recovery. We wanted the hare, we got the tortoise. But the tortoise is making its way to the finish line. And the reason why I'm optimistic is if you think about what happened in early 2009, we're losing 800,000 jobs a month. It had a tremendous impact on consumers. And the reason is this. If you think about the issue of job security, you know, when I got out of college, job security was go find a company where you could work essentially your whole career. Well, that disappeared because of the global economy. Now what people think about when they look for employment is they're looking to get a job, not to work for a company, but to get a job with the hope of getting the next job. If the next job is in the same company, that's great. If the next job is in a different company, that's also great. It's not the company, it's the job that matters, which means that job growth is the key to job security. If I can walk across the street to get another job, I'm secure in my job. I don't really care what happens. When you have the kind of slow growth after the massive layoffs, you have an awful lot of job insecurity. Job insecurity creates low consumer confidence, which creates low spending growth, which creates minimal needs to hire more people. And that is a cycle that had existed. Well, starting about a year ago, what happened is after 2 years of growth, businesses finally discovered that they couldn't work their people longer and harder. They were already doing two, three, and four people's jobs already, other workers' jobs already, and productivity was beginning to fade, and demand was growing slowly, and they started hiring. And that's gone in fits and starts. Yes, you know, job growth was strong, then it comes down. This is kind of normal. It's the March number I'm not worried about, because it's not unusual to have the ebb and flow as far as jobs are concerned. But the reality is that as people are seeing the unemployment rate come down, as they're seeing more jobs become available, they're actually becoming more confident. They're less fearful about losing their jobs. They think that, you know, maybe not next week, but sometime in the next 6 or 12 months, they could actually get another job if they want one. And that is improving consumer confidence. Spending is picked up. To give you an idea, vehicle sales hit in March almost a 15 million unit annualized pace, up from 9 million at the bottom in the peak of the recession. We've seen consumers start to buy again, all sorts of big ticket items and little ticket items, soft goods and hard goods, and they're spending again. That's the fundamental, because once they start spending again, this job growth will be sustained. It may go up and down, but it'll be sustained. And as that's sustained, confidence will continue to build, spending will continue to build, and the recovery will continue. That doesn't mean there aren't hurdles. There are still plenty of hurdles out there. $4 a gallon of gasoline doesn't help, that's for certain. But hopefully it's peaked and it'll come down. And every penny that gasoline prices comes down puts between $1 billion and $1.2 billion back in the pockets of households, and that can create an additional spending as we go through the summer and into the fall. We have the problems in Europe and in China. Clearly, Europe's in recession. You know, a lot of the countries are having major problems. China's slowing down. But this is only one small part. As long as Europe doesn't crash and burn, and I don't think any of us at this point have that in our forecast, we'll be able to make it through. We'll lose some of our exports, but it won't kill the growth. And we have fiscal policy. You know, we know that cutbacks are continuing all across the board in state and local governments especially, and a job is a job is a job. Last year, almost 200,000 jobs were lost in the public sector, which meant that the private sector had to create 200,000 jobs before there was one job created in the economy as a whole. So it's a slowdown. Cutbacks may be necessary, but it also has a short-term negative implication. Nevertheless, it's this job market change, the cycle moving from insecurity to security, to rising confidence, growing demand, and growing job growth that I think has reached a stage that's sustainable and will keep us going. It doesn't mean that we're going to have 4 or 5% growth. We still have those hurdles. We still have to get over, you know, some of the issues that remain in housing and finance and Europe and everywhere else. So we may only get 3.25% growth, but it'll be consistent growth. And we can look at that. And what that means for the region, which is slowly coming back as well. It's not performing nearly as well as the nation. But the unemployment rates are also coming down. We're beginning to get some job growth. We've seen some stability, if not, it depends on the different surveys, but some of the price increases, and I know we may hear this, in housing are beginning to occur. We're seeing a change in the fundamentals. And the region is pretty well positioned to go forward as it has a number of strengths, especially as we've always liked to talk about the EDs and MEDs, which is going to be nothing but growth going forward. And it doesn't have the imbalances. We're not talking huge numbers of distressed homes that will lay on top of this economy for an extended period of time. We're not, you know, we're not Phoenix. We're not Las Vegas. We're not, you know, Miami. You know, so we don't have the problems that are restraining growth. So my expectation is as long as we can continue the national economy, you know, growing at this moderate pace, and that is my forecast, we will start seeing, I believe, an acceleration in growth locally to where we'll come back to the national growth pace. And that's my outlook, which in the past we've usually been somewhat slower. So I'm even optimistic about here because I think there's a lot of factors at work which will allow us to at least match national growth rate over the next few years. Thank you.
Thank you so much. That was really, you know, satisfying and positive. You know, this is what we read, and it's good to hear from our expert that things are not bleak. Actually, things are rosy, and there are better days to look forward to. Thank you so much, Joel. Next, I would like to introduce Mr. Bruce Papperon. Bruce is the president of Bruce Papperon, Inc., a company that builds primarily single-family move-up luxury homes and communities in southern New Jersey region. Very timely, very apt industry sector that we need to have some in-depth report on and some analysis on. So Bruce, a past president, member of the board of directors of the Builders League, so his knowledge base is beyond his business. He understands this marketplace and is aptly suited for to give us his analysis and perspective of where he thinks the housing market is going. And is it going to be as rosy as Joel's prediction is? Oh, yes.
Well, hopefully I can back up some of what Joel has talked about here. You know, it's interesting that you know something is up with real estate if I've been invited back to speak on the panel after four years of a hiatus here. But to those of us in the real estate industry, it almost seems as though time has stood still over the last 5.5 years. You know, there's been very little investment in new communities, new projects. Existing projects have kind of stood, without being completed or finished. There just was not enough sales absorption, you know, to take care of all the standing lot inventory that was out there. However, things do appear to be changing right now, and that is one of the positive things that we can look at. There's no question that the market's improving. 2012 is clearly different. Our traffic is up, sales are up, and buyers' attitudes are also vastly different. They're actually coming into the offices ready and willing to buy right now. I knew things were going to be different in the beginning of this year, when I was reading some articles on three New Jersey economists, very different from Joel. I've always enjoyed listening to Joel. But these three fellows have been the most pessimistic, negative viewers of real estate, the real estate market in New Jersey. The three fellows are Patrick O'Keefe, Jeffrey Otto, and Rutgers' own Jim Hughes. And all three of them had come out and said that New Jersey would see an increase in new home sales in 2012. Now, they also had come out and said that 2011 was the bottom, which I thought was extremely encouraging. This was the first time I heard anything positive from any one of them, much less all three of them, at the same time. The other positive factor that we had in the beginning of the year was the press. When the market went down in 07 and 08, everybody was blaming the press because they would print negative articles about real estate. Well, the fact is that this year we've seen nothing but really positive information coming out of them. And most of it is all true, of course. Just to go through some of them. In March, we saw building permits rise to the highest level in 3.5 years. New home sales in the Philadelphia region are up 30 to 40% in the first quarter. Finished lot inventories have dropped from a 55-month supply to a 39-month supply. And foreclosures look to have peaked in 2009 and 10, having dropped in 11 and also so far in 2012. Now, if you're interpreting these numbers, there's reason to be optimistic. And even our own sales at Paparone New Homes reflect this trend. Our traffic is up 40% in the first quarter. Our sales deposits are up 26%, and contracts signed year-to-date so far have doubled compared to last year at this time. Now, one of the positive changes also that occurred and has been very good for our company has been something that I call the thawing of land assets. And what that is that from 2007 to 2011, there was a number of developments that just sat dormant, frozen in time. Now, these communities were either tied up in bank foreclosures or the sellers were holding out for the market to improve. Well, the realization that present real estate values are what they are have finally sunk in. And at that point, most of the sellers were either unwilling to continue to build or financially did not have the wherewithal to continue to build these communities. So we were able to come in and help them out by marketing and selling their projects, as well as giving ourselves a number of new, diverse locations at today's market rate pricing. We added 8 new communities between last year and this year in markets such as Mount Laurel, Cherry Hill, Washington Township, Deptford, Woolwich, Mickleton, the Mullica Hill area. So it was kind of a win-win situation where we're bringing on new projects at the same time helping them to get rid of their lot inventories. We were also very fortunate to have been featured in an article last year in the Philadelphia Inquirer business section. Alan Heavens, one of the writers, had done a feature on one of these communities that we built in Washington Township, where we took over a cul-de-sac, about a half a dozen lots remaining on a project, which early in 2011, we sold it out in a little less than 3 months at an average price of over $500,000 a house. So there wasn't all doom and gloom out there that houses in the right location at the right price were selling. So, you know, that was kind of a nice thing. The Associated Press picked that up. One of the funny things is I was meeting with friends of ours in Miami at a conference, and they're from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. And the wife says to me, "Bruce, we saw your picture in the paper in the Cedar Rapids Gazette." I was like, "What?" And so it's kind of a neat thing that it was one of those, it was a positive real estate news. But I also believe the biggest reason we're seeing renewed vigor in home buying activity in 2012 is that the buying public realizes that new home prices have hit bottom, that they've bottomed out. And there's a couple of indicators that suggest this as well. A lot of indicators are lagging indicators, but these two are kind of more current. One of them is the Trulia Home Asking Price Monitor, and the other one is the John Burns Consulting Home Value Index. Both of these are indicating that prices are no longer declining, and have stabilized. Now, prices may move sideways for a while for some time, but hopefully no more declines. And I would like to finish up with this. J.P. Morgan, CEO, had offered an optimistic outlook on the housing market for 2012, and he offered 9 indicators that the housing market is turning around. And I'd like to go through some of these with you. The U.S. population has grown by 3 million people a year since the housing crisis had kicked off 4 years ago. And he projects that there'll be an additional growth of 30 million people over the next decade. Well, at this growth rate, you would typically need about 1.2 million new housing units a year. Now, over the last 4 years, a lot of that demand has been cut in half. So as jobs improve going forward, we should see that demand return and pick up a lot of these housing units. There's also been employment growth, albeit slow, over the last 2 years, adding 3.45 million jobs. Since May of 2007, the existing supply of single-family homes and condos for sale has been cut almost in half, from 4.4 million to 2.7 million today. Another factor is the inventory of homes with delinquent loans or foreclosures has dropped from 5.1 million in 2009 to 3.9 million today. And here's another interesting fact, I don't know fact, but issue he brought up. In half of the housing markets across the U.S., it's currently cheaper to buy than to rent today. So, you know, with the way rents have gone up in these markets, you know, that is another positive for buying a new home. Also, the household debt service ratio is at its lowest since the mid-1990s. Now, this last one, I'm not quite sure I believe this one yet, but it says that mortgage lending standards are starting to ease up, according to a survey of the senior loan officers at the Federal Reserve. Now, we can wait and hear from David if that's actually happening or not, but if that does, that'll certainly bode well for housing. So overall, you can see, based on these factors, I'm extremely optimistic that real estate will be improving here. So I thank you for having me, and I'll take any questions later on.
Oh, thank you very much, Bruce. That was 2 for 2. We will be leaving this place much more cheerful than what we walked in, but that depends on David. Now, David is in a very, very, you know, tight situation with the banking sector, the most vilified sector in the, you know, in the near past. I don't know whether you folks have had a chance to go visit the yourbofa.com website. That's a mock website that is really tearing Bank of America apart. It's a real spoof and good one, very good one. But if at all somebody can take up this challenge and present an analysis that's going to be rosy and good, that's David. You know why? He is not only the president and CEO of Capital Bank of New Jersey, he is an alumni of Rutgers School of Business at Camden. So I don't need any further introduction for David, and I'm going to, David, it's all yours.
Thank you, Dr. Ganesh. Vilified is the right word. I've always been a community banker, and I've always been very proud of what community bankers do. I did not realize the depth of the disdain that people felt for banking, however, until a couple of years ago when I introduced myself in a group something like this. And when I was introduced, it wasn't clear before my introduction that I was a banker. When I was introduced as a banker, I heard chortles from the audience of, oh my gosh, that guy just admitted to the fact that he is a banker. And there is widespread disregard for our industry, some of which is understandable, some of which I think is misplaced, and we'll talk about that a bit today. I'm pleased to be here as a frequent attendee of this event and a proud alum of Rutgers Camden School of Business. I'm happy to be here. When Dr. Ganesh asked me to speak on the topic of banking, I've got a lot to choose from because there's been so much going on over the last several years, but I'm going to limit my comments to 3 different topics. The first is the health of our industry. The second is the role of community banks, such as Capital Bank of New Jersey. And the third is some of the banking-related legislation you're going to be hearing more about over the next 12 months. Let me start with the health of the banking industry. Our industry is improving, and I'd like to direct you to some data that's been provided at your seat. Dr. Ganesh and Sam Collier were kind enough to copy some slides for me, all of which are prepared by the FDIC. And by the way, for those of you who are watching a rebroadcast of this at home, all of these things are readily accessible at the FDIC's website at fdic.gov. And I'll try and give a clear enough description of what I'm reading so you know how to find it. Look first of all for the document that looks like this. This is the most recent FDIC quarterly banking profile that was published in the first quarter of this year. It's a bit of a busy document, but let me direct your attention to the bottom, Table 2B, entitled Problem Institutions and Failed or Assisted Institutions. Look at the middle couple of rows in that table, entitled Failed Institutions. Now, this data reads from right to left in time, so start at the right-hand column, 2006. Back in the heady days of 2006, when no bank could do any wrong and the economy was going gangbusters, no banks failed. Zero banks in the United States of America failed in 2006. Even in 2007, as things began to turn, only three banks failed that year. Then the wave began to crash in 2008. 25 banks failed in 2008. The first big one was IndyMac. IndyMac went down in July of 2008. And I know I have a number of other banking colleagues in the room who will probably agree with what I'm about to say next. When the news of IndyMac broke and there were reports of depositors losing money because they had deposits in IndyMac north of the what was then $100,000 insurance limit, my phone began to ring with concerns from depositors about the safety of their deposits. I got more questions about FDIC insurance in the span of a couple months after that event than I had received in my prior 20 years of banking. The numbers increased from 2008. In 2009, there were 140 bank failures. In 2010, 157. In hindsight, that looks like that was the peak of the number of banks that failed. Last year, we had 92 that failed. And so far this year, there have been only 17 institutions that have failed. So if we extrapolate out for the balance of 2012, if they stay on about that same pace, we're on track for 50-some failures or so in 2012. The other notable thing, though, is not only have the number of bank failures apparently peaked, the size of them has clearly peaked some time ago. Look at the next row down. The 25 banks that failed in 2008, the assets of those failed banks totaled $371 billion. That works out to an average failure size of about $15 billion. The very next year, while it had far more number of failures, the total assets were only about $170 billion for an average failure size of $1.2 billion. So it went from $15 billion for average size to $1.2 billion. The next year went down further to $586 million. In 2011, down again to about $380 million. And so far this year, the average failure size has been less than $300 million. And if you put yourself in the shoes of the FDIC, it kind of makes sense to deal with your biggest problems first and then triage your way down to the smaller and smaller institutions. So it appears that the number of failures has peaked. It appears that the biggest size of the failures has peaked. By that measure, our industry is improving. By other measures as well, bank profitability is up. Delinquency that some of our other speakers referenced, it has already peaked. Banks are having to put away less and less money for problem loans. And you read about the big bank stress tests that were conducted a month or two ago. All but a few of those biggest banks were given the green light to pay more cash dividends to stockholders and initiate stock buyback programs. So by and large, our industry's health is vastly improved and appears to be on an upward trajectory. All that said, we're not out of the woods yet. Look at the couple of rows in that same table just above failed institutions labeled problem institutions. The FDIC publishes a data regarding the institutions it considers at the greatest risk of failure. Those are its problem bank list. They don't tell us who those banks are, but they do tell us how many of them there are and the size. And while that list appears to have peaked, it's not coming down like the other sets of data are. As of the end of 2011, the most recent data that's available, there were 813 banks across the country on the FDIC's problem bank list. Now, put that in context. There's only about 7,300 banks across the country. So about one out of nine banks in this country is on the problem bank list. That's not a real good sign. If you do the math there, $319 billion divided by 813 banks, that's an average bank size of about $400 million. So they tend to be the smaller banks that are on that problem list, which is a good segue to my second topic, the future of community banking. We have a new chairman of the FDIC, Martin Grunberg. He's been acting chairman since the middle of 2011. And I've heard more commentary from him than I've heard from any former FDIC chairman regarding the role of community banks and the importance of community banks, which makes me feel really good as a community banker. But our segment of the banking industry is struggling. Take a look at these slides that are on your chair, please, entitled Community Banking by the Numbers. This is from a presentation and a forum the FDIC conducted earlier this year about community banks. Take a look at this chart. This shows you the decline in the number of banks across the country over the last 25 years. In 1985, there were more than 17,500 banks across the country. As of 2010, there were 7,600. As of today, there's about 7,300. So today, we're at about a third of the number of banks that we had just 30 years ago. If you look at the groupings in that chart, the dark blue are the banks with assets less than $100 million. That's the biggest grouping by number of institutions. As of end of 2010, there were 2,600 banks under $100 million in size. And the next biggest grouping is the grouping that actually my bank falls into, banks with assets between $100 and $250 million. We're right at the $250 million number. More than two-thirds of the total number of banks in this country are in that very, very small size. And I can tell you from firsthand experience, when you're $100 million in size, it's hard to be profitable. No matter what size bank you are, you have big overhead requirements. You have big regulatory and compliance burdens, and you need scale to be able to pay for that. And if you're stuck at $100 million or $150 million, and especially if your capital's tight, and oh, by the way, you got a lot of bad loans in your books, that can be a very sticky situation to get out of. If you're a well-capitalized, well-run bank without a lot of bad loans in your books, I'll tell you, it's a terrific time to be a community banker. Because of that disdain that people feel for banks, especially big banks, to be a community bank that's actively lending money, a part of your community, is still able to make tailored loan approvals, especially for small and mid-sized businesses, that's something the big banks just can't do as well as community banks do. So it's a great time to be us if you're well-capitalized and don't have a lot of bad loans on the books. However, there are a number of community banks that don't quite fit that bill. And for that reason, the total number of banks across the country is going to continue to decline. It may not be so much from failures, because that appears to be ebbing, but you will see more small banks that out of necessity have to be acquired or do a merger so they can bulk up that way to grow and obtain the scale they need to be able to be profitable. So the future is bright for community banking, I believe, but you will see some smaller banks continue to struggle and dwindle in size. The last thing I'll comment on is some proposed legislation you'll be hearing more about. You've all heard of the Dodd-Frank Act that was passed in 2010. That legislation has rewritten and is rewriting a lot of the rules that banks operate under, but 2 years into it, there are still a lot of rules yet to be written. In response to Mr. Paparone's comment about credit underwriting loosening on mortgages, while I'd like to agree with you, I'm not sure I'm seeing that yet, quite frankly. And as some of the Dodd-Frank rules come online in 2013, rules dealing with qualified mortgages and qualified residential mortgages and the very rigid criteria banks are going to be under to qualify someone's ability to repay, it may continue to have a chilling effect on how we're able to qualify homeowners for their home. So I'm not yet seeing a big turnaround in the way that that residential mortgages are qualified. The other thing that you'll hear a lot about in the next 12 months is the role of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac play a huge role in residential mortgages in this country. Something like 3 out of 4 residential mortgages that are done in this country go through Fannie or Freddie. They play a big role, and they're the main reason that in this country we have the luxury of being able to give borrowers 30-year fixed-rate mortgages at low rates with no prepayment penalty. If it weren't for Fannie and Freddie, that product wouldn't exist or wouldn't exist in its current form. But Fannie and Freddie have also created a big liability for us taxpayers who are now on the hook for all of their debt. Congress is going to have a dilemma, which probably won't be dealt with until after November, of the competing objectives of winding down Fannie and Freddie and reducing taxpayers' liability while also not chilling housing. If Fannie and Freddie went away or really scaled their operation back, that would further chill residential mortgage lending and wouldn't be a good thing for housing. And we all know how many other industries and businesses and employment feed off of housing. So expect a lot of debate on Fannie and Freddie and their role going forward. So to wrap it up, the health of the banking industry is improving, but we're not out of the woods. You'll continue to see some failures and some merger and acquisition activity. Little community banks like ours that are well capitalized are continuing to thrive and do very well, and there'll be a lot more legislation you'll be reading about in the newspaper and hearing on the news.
Thank you very much, David. Very insightful analysis. Thank you very much. Now I open it up for Q&A. I know there are a lot of questions. Let's start here.
I'm a private investor, and I have been reading my Wall Street Journal 20 years. I paid my tuition for investing for 20 years. Now I'm in the process to harvest what I have learned and paid. I have a few questions. Like, we talk about globalization because every I live in Medford. All the people I talk to, they complain that the goods are not made in this country. We are not patriotic enough. To me, that's very silly because we are in the stage of globalization. We need to move the goods to the most efficient place, to buy the goods from the most cheapest place. So there was so many resentment from NPR since the interview people, American-made goods. To me, it's nonsense. When you open up Apple computer or iPad, you find those piece from China, piece from the United States, piece from the Thailand. And to me, American public needs to be educated more. And because of the resentment of globalization, because of resentment of not made in that they are made in this country, we are putting lots of hurdles ourselves.
So do I take your question as...
I'm sorry. My question is, I would like to have the panel to give me some feedback about to be patriotic, also to buy goods only made in China. Also, I'd like your panel to give me some input about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. They are quasi-government agencies. To me, they are not helping taxpayers. They are not helping this country because all those CEOs they are not doing their job.
Good. Yeah. So the question is how you balance globalization with economic recovery. Maybe I'll start with George.
Okay. You know, the globalization is inevitable. I don't think you're going to stop it. The issue is what kind of policies you have in place. And first of all, there's an understanding of the resentment. The simple fact is there are winners and losers in any changes that occur. Those who win are not necessarily those who lose. If a company offshores its manufacturing to a developing nation, the company may make more money, but the people who used to work in the manufacturing plant don't. They don't have jobs. So, the idea that there's resentment is very obvious and logical, because the winners are different than the losers under these sets of circumstances. There's been some economic policies that I think many people, both economists and politicians, are rethinking. If you went back 10, 15 years ago, the idea that the U.S. would even want to have a manufacturing sector was a silly thought. And now I think there's a growing understanding of the need for a manufacturing sector. So that changes a whole lot of outlook in terms of the way you operate. And it raises that whole question of fair trade versus free trade, two very, very different issues. And those are issues that will be discussed. But you're not going to turn back globalization. It's just that how do you manage within that context? Do you want to talk, Fanny?
Just a little bit about that from my own perspective. Whether it's globalization or regionalization, it's not about the resentment. It's about having jobs for people here. We have to figure out a way to employ people locally. If a company closes down in New Jersey and moves to North Carolina, as an example, the people in North Carolina don't buy houses in New Jersey, and I have to rely on people who are working here in New Jersey to buy homes from our company. So whether it's North Carolina or China or wherever, we do have to look at ways to produce things locally so that we can feed ourselves. So it's a fact of life that we all have to look at and realize we have to do something about.
Very valid point. Gentleman over there?
One really comment, Joel. I have to completely disagree with you because of the election coming up this year. We need a Ronald Reagan. We're getting two mice that are both running. And you have to instill the confidence in the American public. We all sit there. We all see it. Neither one of those candidates can instill into the public that go out and spend and do things. And until you have that person to lead this country, you're not going to see that happen. But more back to the banking industry, I feel that you guys are the robbers without the mask. You wonder why that business isn't going well? It's because you're sitting there with credit card debt, and people are saying now, and that's the number to look at. Where is the credit card debt going? It's going down. People aren't spending with their credit cards because it's 27 to 30% interest rates. So they're saying to themselves, that's craziness. What am I doing? They're not going to spend. They're going to buy the hard goods that you need because my washing machine broke down, my refrigerator broke down, my car broke down. They've got no choice. But they're not going to go out and eat dinner out or spend because if I put it on my credit card, it's costing me 25 to 30%. When is the banking industry going to get smart again and say, hey, wait a minute, I'll take 5% over what the prime is and get the people to start spending their money again?
Your low opinion of bankers is not only held by you, but I'll tell you, I put my head on the pillow every night, sir, feeling very good about what I do for a living and the people that I help. Now, I'm not in the credit card business, so I can't give you a personal experience on that. I'll tell you that in a open market where banks have to not only compensate themselves for their overhead and a return to their stockholders, but the losses they suffer, that tends to set where those credit card rates need to be. And I know enough about it to know that 5 over prime isn't going to cut it in the credit card business. In response to part of what you said and also this lady's question about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, let me make this comment also. While you might wonder who could have been so asleep at the switch to have let so many unqualified homeowners qualify for mortgages through Fannie and Freddie, keep in mind that for years prior to the crisis, Congress was pushing on Fannie and Freddie to make more homeowners and loosen credit standards. So as Congress has to deal now with what to do with Fannie and Freddie, they have to look in the mirror, too, for who's at fault for driving that process to the extremes that it got to.
I just want to make one other comment about Fannie and Freddie. The reality is that the financial crisis was not caused by Fannie and Freddie. The financial crisis where the financial institutions lost their money were on the securitized loans that were not Fannie and Freddie. If the only problems were Fannie and Freddie, yes, we would have lost $200, $300 billion, which is not a small amount of money, but we would have written that check and moved on. So as much as you want to vilify Fannie and Freddie, keep in mind it was the private sector lending process that created the financial crisis. It was not Fannie and Freddie.
More there.
Hello, Ed Hutchison, Hutchison Mechanical Services. Bruce, what product are you seeing moving out there, and where are people moving to and from and to?
Well, yeah, there are some strong segments of the market in, I'd say, when the first wave of the problems hit, there was a movement down towards that first-time home buyer product line, let's say the $250,000, under $300,000 market. We tend to build, our product is a move-up luxury product. And what we found was all of the other builders had moved, especially the national and public builders, tried to move down to that first-time product. So we kind of made the decision to say, hey, we're going to stay in our product line, what we do best, because it's not that many people doing it right now, so that there's not a whole lot of competition with that. As far as where people are moving from, again, we're just starting to see this movement come back over the last year, let's say, and it still tends to be local. You know, we're not seeing a big reload business yet coming from other areas, although Lockheed Martin has been a great company for our local economy as they have fed a lot of new home buyers coming into the area, so that's been a real positive sign. But for the most part, you know, I say it's local. There are not a lot of new home developments in Brockton County or Camden County. So most of the growth is going to take place down in Gloucester County where there are developable lots to have. So we are seeing people coming out of the Medfords, you know, the Mount Laurels, the Cherry Hills, looking down there as well.
We might have time for one or two questions. I can't see this group, so I don't want to miss anybody here. If they have any questions, please, gentlemen over here.
Sean Nettle. Dave, you mentioned the number of institutions that are considered problematic is over 800. If you ask one of those institutions, are they required to tell you that they're one of them?
Not only are they not required to tell you if they're one of them, they are not permitted to tell you if they're one of them. But very generally, banks are rated on a 5-point scale by the FDIC or the regulator, 1 to 5. It's called a CAMELS rating, 1 being the highest, 5 being the worst rating. The problem banks have a rating of 4 or 5, or in some cases a 3 that's a borderline 4. Those ratings are strictly confidential, and banks are not permitted to tell you that. And the FDIC doesn't publicize the specific names for good reason, because they don't want to create a run on those banks that would simply exacerbate the problem that those banks are facing.
Makes sense. One other question, Joel. Regionally speaking, what industries are driving the recovery, you know, in terms of leading the charge at the top?
The question was which industries are driving the recovery. Unfortunately, or fortunately, it's kind of broad-based, but no real strength. It's a situation where we're seeing job growth in almost every segment, but not a particularly large amount in every segment. So, you know, currently we don't have, and one of the issues of how you get to really strong growth is when you have a sector, an industry that leads the way, generating lots of additional growth. So start building, you know, Bruce, really rapidly so we can get it going. But that's not happening. And that's part of the reasons why we're lagging. There's no real strong industry. You know, we're not getting it out of pharmaceuticals or home construction or anything else. We're just getting growth.
Maybe our last question will go with Joe.
This is for Joel. I've seen many reports saying that there's thousands of manufacturing jobs that aren't getting filled. One of the big problems is the entry-level jobs are not production line. They're technical jobs, technical manufacturing. We haven't talked about the educational community and our role. What should we be doing to help bring the talent to these jobs that are there that they can't fill?
Yeah, the problem we have is the old idea of a mismatch of job growth and skill availability. And if you think about it, you know, over the last 20, 30 years, manufacturing was viewed as a dying industry that nobody wanted to go into, and who was going to be trained to go into manufacturing. And while those skills, those technical skills that are needed now are more general in scope, part of the issue is people don't look at manufacturing as a place to work because of the image it has more than anything else. As far as skill-wise, I think it's more an issue of location. And part of the problem with the housing market right now is if I can't sell my house in Camden County, I can't take a job out in Schuylkill County, you know, and on the other side of the state. That's the problem. We've got labor immobility that's caused by the housing problem, and a lot of the issues that I think that firms are finding is they can't get the workers who would normally move to actually move. So you've got some mismatch in skills, but also a fairly good problem in terms of labor mobility right now.
You know what? I want to thank our panel and everyone here for an excellent, a big round of applause to the panel, please. Very interesting, very insightful, and a timely quarterly business outlook. Thank you all so much. Hope to see you at the 74th quarterly business outlook in July. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this program from the Rutgers University School of Business at Camden. Our thanks to Samantha Collier and Michael Sapanek of Rutgers Camden for their assistance and support in producing these programs. We are looking for sponsorship support for this program series. If your company is interested in sponsoring these podcasts, please drop me a line at steve@lubetkincommunications.com. And we do produce these programs in the studios of Lubetkin Communications in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. We're on the web at lubetkin.net. For everyone at the Rutgers University School of Business in Camden, this is Steve Lubetkin thanking you for being with us, and we'll see you out there on the net. Take good care.